This is Ozarks at Large. We conclude a conversation today with Michael Vandenberg, the co-chair of the Vanderbilt University Energy, Environment, and Land Use Program and a member of the law faculty at Vanderbilt. He was in Fayetteville in October to deliver the keynote address for the 2017 Arkansas Law Review Symposium, devoted this fall to environmental sustainability and private governance. Vandenberg and Jonathan Gilligan have written the new book, Beyond Politics, The Private Governance Response to Climate Change. During Vandenberg's visit to the University of Arkansas this fall, he also came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. On yesterday's program, he discussed how private interests have taken the lead, rather than government regulation, when it comes to sustainable practice and policy. In the second part of our conversation, we discuss public attitudes toward sustainability, reaching all the way back to the 1970s, when then-President Jimmy Carter addressed the nation about the topic.
Jimmy Carter's gotten a bad rap on that. Mm-hmm. It's too easy to belittle the idea that you should wear a cardigan sweater and sit at home and be cold.
He was asking to make a small sacrifice.
He was asking for a small sacrifice, and the answer, though, is we never really explored the nuances of the message he was trying to give, and he probably didn't give it in a way that was as effective as it could be. So we first have to divide the kinds of things that are more like energy efficiency, where you get the same service, but you get it with less energy. So if I buy a more fuel-efficient heating unit, I can get the same amount of heat, but at less cost. So that's efficiency. What Carter was talking about is more conservation. So what he was talking about is reducing the use of something. And that's valuable too. They're both valuable. But what tends to happen is people tend to focus on the one-off conservation items, make fun of them, and then move away. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason for that is there are very few institutions in America that will profit if you don't use energy. So we ultimately have to think about, will your utility in your neighborhood be better off if you don't use their product? Probably not. If that's true, are they likely to put together the most sophisticated programs to induce you to do that? So many utilities are trying in good faith to do small programs, but ultimately this is going to require, I think, work by companies and, again, religious organizations, civic and cultural organizations, philanthropists, because ultimately it's going to take institutions that have an incentive to try to reduce electricity use or natural gas use.
This is nuanced. I mean, this takes more than a 45-second talking head talking to another talking head.
That's
on
right.
A cable. Are you optimistic that we can have – I mean, these conversations are happening, but that the greater us can have these conversations?
I think it's starting to happen, and I think I'm not just naive about that. So I gave a talk at the University of Virginia a couple of weeks ago, and just a few days beforehand, Facebook had announced that it was putting a new billion-dollar data center into Virginia, and Dominion Power, the electric company, was going to sell it 100% renewable power. And so you know, in the South, I see this in Tennessee, when new businesses arrive, they say, we'll arrive in your state, but you better provide renewable power. So I think what we're seeing is enough of an incentive through efficiency, through the declining cost of renewable power, and through people's sense that although they don't like big government, they're also not blind to the fact that we've got problems out there, that we can have a cleaner environment. So I think there's a growing sense of that, and I think as government gets less and less in the business of playing the role of being the environmental protector, I think what you're seeing is individuals and companies and others stepping up. There was a movement when the Trump administration stepped away from the Paris Agreement called We Are Still In. Hundreds of companies, dozens of universities, many cities said, no, we're still in.
Fayetteville mayor.
Being one of them. So I think what you're seeing is not that the private sector can solve the problem, but it's stepping in a very big way. And I think one other piece that I find fascinating, I think we'll turn the corner when we begin to realize that this issue is neither liberal nor conservative. I did a study years ago that looked at the question of personal responsibility. And what we found is that conservatives talked about personal responsibility all the time, except not when it came to the environment. Liberals talked about the environment all the time, but never talked about personal responsibility. And to me, that's the gap that's out there. And I think the gap that needs to be closed is to say we need to take personal responsibility for our environmental behavior. And when we do that as a corporate manager or a civic organization leader or a household member, then when you aggregate those activities together, you can actually get, we believe, a billion tons of carbon emissions and a lot of other environmental problems saved too.
I can hear someone listening to our conversation, mm-hmm. but yelling at the radio saying, hey, wait a second. We do need government involvement. Triangle Factory Fire, Exxon Valdez,
right.
Bhopal, and Union Carbide. I mean,
that's right.
Someone's got to watch, they would argue.
So nothing in the work that I do with Jonathan Gilligan, my co-author on this project, nothing that we do suggests that we don't ultimately need a role for government. We're even very carefully selecting the kind of initiatives we discuss to make sure they're not the kind of initiatives that might displace government. What we're looking for instead is to buy time. And so the thought is not that we don't need a strong government role. The kinds of things we're talking about can fill gaps, but they're unlikely to completely solve problems.
How much time do we have?
On climate, the cost goes up tremendously every decade we wait, and there may be some thresholds that if we pass them, we can't go back. So our view is that we need to start right now, and that if we wait a decade before we fully engage on this issue, it will be too late. And by too late, I mean that the cost will get to be astronomical. And again, we will get to a point where this is largely irreversible at some point. We just don't know where that point is, and that's part of the problem. My physicist co-author describes this problem as being like driving down the highway in a car with a tachometer, measuring your revolutions per minute. And you can ride in the red zone in the tachometer where the car is going very fast for a period of time, and that doesn't mean that your motor is going to freeze up automatically, but the risk of it doing so goes up logarithmically. And so we face the same problem with the climate issue. We don't know how long we can stay well above a 2 degrees Celsius kind of temperature. No one scientist can tell us that. But if you are conservative about taking risk, then you don't want to stay in that red zone any longer than you have to.
And that tachometer for someone in Funafuti or Marshall Islands is more red than it is for those of us in the middle of the United States.
That's right. I mean, there's at least one argument that we're 10 feet committed on sea level already, when you can just do the math on that. I guess the other problem on climate that I think people don't give enough attention to is we almost, when we look at climate reports and we listen to debates about climate, we almost are doing those reports and those debates as if time ends in 2100. So we talk about where will sea level be in 2100. Maybe it'll be 2 feet, maybe 1 feet, maybe 3 feet. We don't really know for sure. To me, what is inexcusable is that we're not talking about the fact that the 500 generations after 2100 will still be dealing with what we've done today. And so what we do in the next 2 decades might ultimately have an effect that will last for 500 generations. Unless we can come up with some way to take the carbon back out of the air, a substantial percentage of everything we release today will still be warming the atmosphere 10,000 years from now. So there are almost no other problems we deal with that have that kind of long tail. To deal with that a little bit, people always criticize some of the kinds of things that we work on by saying, yes, but people don't care about the deep future. So we actually did a study of that. We asked people, if you had $100, how much of that $100 would you devote to having a better reputation today during your lifetime versus after you die? Because this is a problem where the climate problems won't become particularly egregious in the next 20 or 30 years. Once they get serious, it's going to be hard to get rid of them. They could last for 5 or 10,000 years. So the issue is really not what people think of us today. It's what they will think of us in future generations. What will your grandchildren think of you, your great-grandchildren, and their great-grandchildren? And what we found was striking, which is that almost $40 by the average individual would be devoted to buying a better reputation after they die. And particularly strongly, people believe that your reputation among your offspring after you die, or your relatives, people you're related to, really matters. So we know that people do care. And one of the things we suggested is a legacy registry. So the idea is right now, whatever you or I do won't be known. What the presidents do will probably be known, and maybe the Senate Majority Leader or the House Speaker. But for most of us, we're essentially anonymous over multiple generations. But that's a solvable problem. What we could do is create a database that allows all of us to simply record what we believed and what we did today and have that information stored in a way that would make it available to our great-great-grandchildren. And we could ask people, well, what do you want them to think about you? What do you want them to know? And put your money where your mouth is.
I love that idea.
Challenge for all of us is that when we ask computer experts, what kind of electronic database should we use? They said the best way to preserve data is to print it out.
So it's never easy.
It's never easy.
Where can people find out more about your work?
We have a book coming out called Beyond Politics, and we have a Beyond Politics book website, so it can be found there. The book is available for pre-order on Amazon and is available will be available in independent bookstores as well. So for now, if you just search for Beyond Politics or either of our last names, Vandenberg and Gilligan, you'll come up with our website and the book. And the book is a long slog. I won't kid you. It has some light passages, but it's not an easy read in places. But we hope people will be able to pick chapter by chapter and find the areas that really matter to them.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It's a joy.
Michael Vandenberg is the co-chair of the Vanderbilt University Energy, Environment, and Land Use Program and is a member of the law faculty at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He was in Fayetteville in October to deliver the keynote address for the 2017 Arkansas Law Review Symposium, devoted this year to environmental sustainability and private governance. Michael Vandenberg and Jonathan Gilligan have written the new book, Beyond Politics, The Private Governance Response to Climate Change.